Okay, great. So last class we were looking at, we want to express quantum mechanics as a theory in Hilbert space. We saw that we had a problem, position and momentum operators. The eigenstates of those operators don't belong to L2R, which is the only separable Hilbert space we have available to us. So that means that we need some way to address how to do computation with position and momentum. We saw Dirac's approach, which was to just enlarge the Hilbert space to include functions which are not in L2R and have these kind of provisional rules for accommodating the position and momentum eigenstates. A more rigorous approach within the, well, maybe not more rigorous, but an approach that's rigorous within the Hilbert space picture is the approach due to von Neumann, where he wrote down a generalized spectral decomposition for self-adjoint operators of this form, where the objects E sub lambda are a one-parameter spectral family. Well, let me just not use that notation. Let me just call it. Let me just say they define a spectral. Okay, never mind. I will say this. R a one-parameter spectral family. Okay, and this produces a projector valued measure. DE lambda, that's what appears in this decomposition. And heuristically, in terms of the Dirac approach, you can think of dE lambda as meaning lambda lambda d lambda. Okay, where lambda is not an element of L2R. Okay, so these would be, for example, the plane wave eigenstates of momentum, or the Dirac delta function, which is a distribution function, eigenstates of position. Okay, so that's just heuristically. Everyone knows what heuristically means? It's kind of hand waving. But rigorously, we interpret integral of lambda dE lambda as what's called a Lebesgue-Stieltjes integral. And I'll give you an example of this now, and that example ends up being sufficient in practice for evaluating these things. Okay, any questions about the motivation for this or the setup?
Is this one more powerful than the Dirac approach or the equivalent?
I'm sorry?
Is this approach more powerful than the Dirac approach to
inferential? Yeah, I don't know any instances where the two are distinguished. But I suspect that it is, I think it's more mathematically satisfying. Well, there's criteria of elegance that can come in which aren't necessarily practical. So that's what I've before, but I haven't seen any particular reasons for this approach. over Dirac's. Except that, I mean, the, you know, what is it? Occam's razor. I mean, we can now have our postulates of quantum mechanics as we want them. States live in Hilbert space. Any other questions? So here, let me give you this example. But before I do that, so your question last Friday about why it was that the momentum operator was not self-adjoint on L2AB. So you're exactly right. It has everything to do with evaluating the integration by parts at the boundary. That's what condition that fails if that boundary is not at infinity. So that's how that works out. The details of it, it's actually quite a lengthy analysis, so I'm not going to go into the details. And then there was another question in the back. I think you were concerned about why these functions were differentiable since L2R doesn't have a continuity constraint. What did you find out?
A few things. So for example, in general, like C-infinity functions with complex support are dense in L2R.
Mm-hmm.
So for almost every function, you could define a differentiability. But that doesn't extend to the whole space. For example, if you consider the derivative operators, usually they are bounded. So there is like a theorem called, I don't remember the name, Hellinger-Toeplitz theorem or something like that, which basically means that a function, like a functional, sorry, an operator, which is everywhere defined, has to be bounded, and vice versa. So if it's not bounded, then it cannot be everywhere defined. So you cannot really define that derivative anywhere, everywhere. So they have some different approaches. Like if it's symmetric, then you can actually extend it. You can find some extension.
Yeah, symmetric extensions. Yeah.
So
I think the short answer is that the functions in L2R on which the momentum operator is well defined constitute its domain, and part of the self-adjointness criterion is that you want the domain of the operator and the domain of its adjoint to be the same, which suggests that the domain is not the full space in general. And so while we don't guarantee a continuity condition, it's not necessary to talk about the domain. The domain would be functions that are differentiable. Okay, good. So now let's work through the example of a position measurement. So the position operator, which we'll call capital Q. So it has eigenstates which satisfy a relation of the type okay, but psi is not an L2R. Okay, but Q has a dense domain. So now we're going to identify the spectral family via the Heaviside function. So we say that Q of A acting on psi of x is equal to theta A minus x psi of x. Where this is the Heaviside function. Or step function. And this means we can apply von Neumann's spectral decomposition as integral over dqa psi of x, acting on psi of x. And now we interpret this, as a Stieltjes integral. Which means we have Q of psi x is equal to an integral. Sorry, we replace the integral with a finite sum and then take the infinite limit. of AK minus Q of AK minus 1 acting on psi of x. Where the set of points AK define a partition of R of the real line. And that partition gets increasingly fine as n goes to infinity. So what we have is that AK minus AK minus 1 goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. For every k. And then direct evaluation of this limits of this limit gives us the relation we need. So the point here is that we've avoided making any assumptions about psi being an L2R, and we're still able to evaluate the action of the position operator on the wave function via identifying the spectral family in this way. And so the same thing works if we just go to the momentum representation, then it's exactly the same. Okay. So, any other questions about that? Yes?
I can't remember what dense domain.
What is what?
Dense domain.
It means that that it has an element, it acts properly on a state that's arbitrarily close to every state in the space. So every point, think of each point in L2R as a function. So not all the functions in L2R are the action of the operator is not well-defined on all functions in L2R, but it's well-defined on a sufficiently dense set of points that you can be arbitrarily close to any other point. Okay, so this was a more technical... So as I mentioned at the beginning of the class, there are certain issues like dealing with infinite dimensions, which coming up with some kind of rigorous understanding of what justifies the tricks we use to compute things is actually extremely involved and in practice isn't really necessary. So it's nice just to get a flavor of the kind of functional analysis that goes into defining these things. But in practice, we can get away with just knowing the rules for manipulating these systems without needing to understand kind of how the engine works. Okay, so we're going to go move on to a new section of the course, which is how to, we've set up a description of textbook quantum mechanics in terms of a mathematical formulation of its postulates. But in practice, when you try and describe real-world systems, these postulates don't apply. They're inadequate in some sense to describe the systems we come across. So let me explain what I mean by that and give you a richer mathematical formalism, which is actually less technically complicated than this stuff, but just it's a slightly different way of thinking about quantum systems that allows you to describe the real world fact that when you prepare a system, you're not going to be able to assign a pure state to describe it. When you have some dynamical transformation, you're not going to be able to describe it perfectly with a unitary operator. And when you do a measurement, you're not going to be able to describe that with a projector or a projector-valued measure. It's not just a matter of dealing with the messy details of real-world experiments, but also what we'll see is that this generalized formalism points to a greater capacity for analyzing systems. So an example of what I mean by that, and I think that Aggie has a problem along these lines in your tutorials or homeworks, is that when you realize that you have this larger formalism available to describe real-world systems, you'll find that that actually increases the ability you have to perform certain tasks. So if you have some device which is preparing a system in one of several different ways, and you want to be able to do a measurement which gives you the best chance of guessing which preparation procedure applied, then by using this generalized formalism, you'll see that you can do better than just by measuring the spectral decomposition of some self-adjoint operator. You have greater capabilities, so that'll become clear once we get to that part. So it's not just a matter of dealing with messy details, but also pointing to what is the greatest functionality available to me when using quantum systems to achieve goals such as processing information. Okay, so the new section we're starting is we're going to talk about the operational postulates for realistic systems. And an important point of emphasis here is going to be to relate how these postulates tie into our primitive postulates, our ideal postulates. And we'll see that they arise as a special case. Even though they appear to be more general, but they're actually a special case of the ideal postulates. So that's a point we'll get to. Okay, so we'll start out with some pretty trivial things, and bear with me, it'll get more complicated as we go. Okay, so now suppose suppose a device probabilistically prepares a system in state, what was my notation here? In state psi 1 with probability p1, and it also prepares the system in state psi 2 with probability p2. Now suppose we're measuring some operator A, written in terms of spectral decomposition, where the piles are projectors. Okay, then the probability of outcome A conditioned on preparation 1 is equal to the trace of, I should call it AL, trace of pi L against preparation psi 1, and the probability of outcome AL conditional on preparation 2. You know, it's unfortunate that I just don't have time in this class to review how probability and conditional probability works. That's something you should know well, because it's something that is often missed in the standard undergrad training. So here's the conditional probability of outcome AL, where the conditioning is on point 2. This is important. So Feynman, you know, Nobel winning scientist. So he messes up conditional probability in his analysis of the double slit experiment. Okay, so it's easy to get confused about conditional probability. So here, this is the probability of outcome L conditioned on preparation 2. So what's the overall probability of getting outcome AL? So if I don't know which preparation occurred, then the overall probability that I'm going to assign to outcome AL is going to be probability P1 times the probability of AL given 1 plus probability 1 minus P1 times the probability of outcome AL given state 2. Okay, so these probabilities here, these are the same things. The trace is a linear function of either argument. So that means that we can write this as the trace of pi L against P1 psi1 psi1 plus P2. Sorry, P2 is short for 1 minus P1. Psi2 psi2. Okay, so now we have the Born rule again, but we have a different object in here than a projector. Okay, so now let's identify this entire thing with the symbol rho. It's obviously a linear operator because a linear combination of linear operators is a linear operator. So now we have some linear operator rho, and we want to think about this as representing the preparation now directly. Whoops. Oh, this is the backboard, I see. Okay. So in general, we can have, via this same argument, we can talk about some density operator that's given by an arbitrary, what's called a convex combination, which is a probabilistic combination. Where this can be a finite or infinite sum. And we can also have a continuous integral. Notation am I using here? D lambda, P lambda, psi lambda. Psi lambda. Obviously, lambda is a dummy variable here. Okay, where in each of these cases, where PL and P lambda are probability, well, this is a probability distribution and this is a probability density. So I'll just call them probabilities. So the fact that the probabilities of the probability distribution, the elements are between 0 and 1 and sum to 1. For the probability density, we just require that it's real valued and integrates to 1. Because the probability density has units of probability per unit length. So it's not constrained between be between 0 and 1. Okay, so let's call rho a density operator. And let's remark a couple of things. Let's observe that rho, let's call this 1 and let's call this 2. Rho defined via 1 or 2 satisfies two important properties. The first property is that called property A is that rho is non-negative. Okay, it's a probabilistic combination of projectors. Projectors are non-negative operators, so any linear probabilistic combination of them is also a non-negative operator, which means that its eigenvalues are non-negative. Zero eigenvalues are allowed. And the second property, which we can directly observe, is that there's a normalization condition. So it turns out these two conditions are going to define density operators for us. But first, let's make sure we're not missing anything by considering a slightly more general scenario. So what's a more general scenario? So here I gave you some operational scenario where we wanted to use a different object than a rank one projector, or then a Hilbert space ray, or Hilbert space vector if you prefer, to describe the preparation procedure. which preserved the structure of the Born rule. Can you think of another operational scenario where I'm going to need something other than a Hilbert space ray to describe my preparation? So remember, we saw that when you have a composite system, we have states of the composite system which were, we called entangled. They couldn't be expressed as just a product of factors of states on each space. So what if my preparation procedure is I prepare a state that's entangled with some ancilla, call that ancilla system B, and then the measurement I perform is only on system A. What kind of object can I use to describe the preparation procedure? Clearly, it's a pure state on some bigger Hilbert space, but it's not going to be a pure state on the factor space of system A. So what is the kind of object we need in that case? Well, it's again going to be a density operator satisfying these two conditions. Okay, so now I should have given this a number. So now suppose instead we prepare an entangled state we call it psi, which is an element of HA tensor HB. And we measure an operator A, which is a linear operator on the Hilbert space of system A. Okay, so again, A has a spectral decomposition where pi L is also a linear operator on the Hilbert space. And let me just emphasize here, I find that particularly undergrads have a hard time switching from thinking about preparations as vectors to preparations as operators. So let me just underscore the fact that rho is a linear operator on HA, whereas psi is a vector in HA. All right, so in order to have this more general description, we're not using vectors in the Hilbert space, but operators acting on the Hilbert space to model, to represent, or describe the preparation. Notice avoiding the language of saying that the mathematical object isn't the system, it's a description of the system. Okay, so now we can recall the Born rule. And we have the probability of outcome AL is going to be equal to the trace of A tensor identity on B times this preparation psi. Okay, so remark that because we need to multiply two operators together, we need to make sure that they're operators in the same Hilbert space. Okay, so the point is that A tensor the identity is an element of the linear operators on HA tensor HB. Okay, and similarly, psi, the projector here, is a linear operator on HA tensor HB. So we're comparing apples with apples now, okay? Yeah?
Should that be pi A instead of A in the bracket?
Where are we?
On the right side where we're tracing.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Pi L, and in fact, I want to change it here too. Thank you. So remember that our rule is that we learned about the tensor product, and obviously this tensoring distributes across this sum, okay? So what that means is that A tensor identity on B is equal to a sum over L AL pi L tensor identity on B. Okay, and then this is probably crystal clear to you guys, but just to make sure, identity on B denotes a linear operator on HB. Okay, this is the identity operator, which means that it takes every state to itself in HB. Okay, so this is an adequate way. This is our postulates tell us this is the right way to describe the probability of AL. So we're done in a way. But now what we're going to do is we're going to demand that we have some description of this in the smaller Hilbert space. Okay, so we're done. In the sense that we have a complete description of the statistics, but we want mathematical objects, we want to define mathematical objects relevant to HA only. And this is out of convenience. Okay, so for those of you who have come across the operational formulation of quantum mechanics before, which this isn't my idea, this is the approach championed by Asher Perez, Leslie Ballantyne, Lucien Hardy, who pioneered it, and then many others have followed since, realizing this is the best way to think about quantum mechanics. So the point is, one point that's not stressed is that we do this out of convenience. The ideal postulates are perfectly adequate for describing this situation. I can compare this to any experiment you're going to do in the lab, and I won't be missing anything. But now, out of convenience, we want to describe everything in the smaller Hilbert space. And one of my issues is that people tend to elevate to the level of a postulate, like I did, as some kind of fundamental characterization of quantum mechanics. But I think that's misleading. I think that's not the right way to think about things. It's a bit like, I would say, just a second, let me finish the thought. Look, if I have a Lagrangian system or Hamiltonian system classically, I can model that system fundamentally via Lagrange's principle, and I can come up with a description of its dynamics. But now someone says, hey, but your description doesn't include friction. Okay, if I roll a ball along a flat surface, it's actually going to come to a stop because of friction. But your theory, your fundamental theory, gives me conservation of energy and momentum. So clearly your formula is inadequate. And I said, no, it's not inadequate. It's just that you haven't taken into account the other degrees of freedom pertaining to, the surface that you're rolling the ball on, the air molecules and such. And if you included all that, then energy and momentum would be conserved, but conserved in the greater system. And then someone says, well, that's really messy. I just want to describe how the ball comes to a stop. I don't want to include 10 to the 23 degrees of freedom in my description. And you say, okay, what you can do is you can adopt an effective model of friction where you add a term which is proportional to the velocity to the differential equations, and that's a phenomenological model of dissipation. And it's adequate and it's simple because it doesn't complicate things that much. It just adds another term to the differential equation without adding more degrees of freedom. So similarly, that's the spirit here. Yes, Aggie?
Yeah, it seems like you switched notation from last week by using capital pi instead of p.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. I have switched notation. I do that a lot. Two common things are projectors. So let me just define pi L not define, but insist that this set of objects are orthonormal and they're self-adjoint, which together imply that pi's are projectors. So I use the notation p or pi for projectors. Also for the position operator, I use q or x, and I kind of can't help but switch back and forth, often in the same problem. So bear with me for that. Anything else? No? Okay, good. All right, so out of convenience, we want to have a more compact description which doesn't involve other degrees of freedom in the environment. So let me just finish saying here, out of convenience for a more compact model of the system, yes.
When you write the probability, why do you do the tensor product with one at the top?
Here? Because if I want to, so think about this is an operator and this is an operator. Okay, so the object, so just remark. So let O be a linear operator in HA tensor HB. So then A times O is not really well defined. Think about it. What does this mean if I have two operators back to back and I want to actually compute something? I have to choose a matrix representation and then I multiply the matrices together, right? But this matrix O has dimension. Let's assign HA to have dimension M and HB to have dimension N, right? So then O is an MN by MN dimensional matrix. But A is just m by m dimensional. So I can't multiply them together. So how do I multiply them together? Well, I realize what I really mean here is A tensor identity. So I'm applying A to the system A, and I'm applying identity to, I'm doing nothing to system B. I'm applying identity to it. And then you realize that A tensor identity is m by n, mn by mn dimensional. And the way we discussed this last week, let me just remind you that if I have a matrix A with matrix elements A11, A12, let me make these capital for clarity, A13, A21, and I multiply this by identity, what's the identity matrix, right? That's just all ones. All right, so what does the composite matrix look like? Well, we use this notation where the rightmost system, the index for that varies most rapidly. So this becomes equal to, so this is A tensor identity now expressed as a matrix representation. It's this matrix times just this matrix multiplication now. And it's going to be a matrix of the form A 0 0 0, A 0 0 0. Okay, so we have a block diagonal matrix where the diagonal blocks consist of the original matrix A repeated n times. So we have n copies of this m by m matrix. And so we insert the identity so that it's clear what we're talking about. Now what's going to happen is that what you'll see is, and when you do read papers and so on, people will actually drop the identity here. They won't tell you it's there, and just it's understood that when they have two matrices like this next to each other, what they really mean is A tensor identity times zero, which means if you write it out as a matrix, you have to include this form of it, because O is going to be a big matrix with independent elements everywhere. And so you have to, does that help? It depends on the context. It depends on what that operator is doing. If it's next to another operator of a different dimension, then yes, the identity is implicit. But I don't think I left any implicit identities last class. So I'm assuming that if there should have been an identity there, I included it. But if you're multiplying pi or p against an operator that's in this acts on the same Hilbert space, then you don't need to include identity because they're already the same dimension. Okay, thanks for that question. All right, so I'm gonna So actually, yeah. So my example in the notes, I'm actually using A here. So I'll switch back to A. Basically, it's equivalent via this linearity, via this spectral decomposition. Via the spectral decomposition and the linearity of the trace, whether I think about A or one of its the terms in its decomposition is immaterial. It doesn't matter. So what we're going to do is we're going to consider a measurement. Well, we've already done that. Let's consider the explicit matrix representation. Actually, just like what we just did in the example now. So what we have is, let me do it this way. All right, I'm talking about the expectation value. The expectation value of A tensor identity is equal to the trace of A tensor identity times psi psi. And let's call this rho AB. It's a linear operator on HAB. In fact, it's just a projector, so it's a very special case of a linear operator. And now we look at an explicit representation. So here, I hope the notation is obvious. If the notation is not obvious, let me know. And now we insert a resolution of the identity. Okay, so remember we can sum over any basis of outer products to construct a resolution of identity. Okay, so this piece here is just equal to identity on AB. And then our original matrix representation, we're looking at rows and columns. So this is L prime, and this is B K prime. Where is row AB? Ah, thank you. Row AB is right there. All right, there's row AB. Okay, thank you for catching that. All right, so now we can write this out in terms of index gymnastics here. We have an expression of the following form. Whoops, so no, there's no hat. So now the point is that these are the matrix elements, which I think I have a typo here. This is no prime there. These are the matrix elements of A. And these are the matrix elements of row AB. Okay, so the way you read this is, yeah, thank you. Yeah, perfect. All right, so the way to read this is that LK refers to a row, and L prime, K prime refer to a column. So remember our rows. So in this picture here, so here we have m rows n times. Okay, so L picks out which submatrix you're in, and K picks out which element of that submatrix you're in. And then we're referring to either a row or a column. Okay, now we can rewrite this as sum over L prime L, A L prime L, sum over K, rho L K, L prime K. Because of this Kronecker delta function. All right, now suppose we let rho A stand for some linear operator representing the preparation, representing system A, okay? If we can do that, if this assumption is valid, then we would have the expectation of A is equal to the trace of A against rho A, which if we write it out in terms of indices, we would have a sum over L prime L, A L prime L, rho A L prime L prime, L prime L. And then we can just identify this with this object here. Okay, so now we identify rho A, whose matrix entries are L prime L, with the matrix entries defined via this analysis in the full Hilbert space. Well, here the parentheses are confusing, so I'll remove them. So this is row AB. I've dropped the AB subscript when I'm talking about the matrix elements, okay? So you could just think of this as AB. Okay, so when we do that, we do this by demanding that the Born rule works whether we talk about the larger system or not. We're demanding that A tensor identity expectation value is equal to the expectation value of A. So A tensor identity was this expression, and A alone is this simple expression in terms of some fictional operator, which we hope could describe our preparation. And then we find, indeed, if we make this identification, then we recover an equivalence. And then you can ask, what are the properties of operators obtained in this way? Okay, so we find that rho A defined in this way perfect. We still good with the audio?
Yep.
Okay, great. We find rho A defined in this way satisfies condition A. We have that rho A is a non-negative operator. And condition B, the trace of rho A is equal to 1. So it's the same properties we found via the other approach. So now we're confident that we've captured the full generality of what can happen. And so now we can just postulate that the most general description of any preparation procedure, whether it's a mixture of pure states or seeing only part of a quantum system that's entangled, in both cases we recover an object that satisfies these properties, which we take to define density operators. Yes?
I think in this expectation value of A, the subscript on A, one of the subscripts should be squished.
Here?
No, the right-hand side. Yeah.
Here?
Yes, it should squish.
Oh.
And one of them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so let me just state this as a postulate, although accept that it's a postulate with a grain of salt. So we'll call it a practical postulate. The most general preparation procedure or instead of the most general, let me just say any preparation procedure on a Hilbert space can be represented by a density operator. Okay, so a special case of a density operator is a rank one projector, which is a pure state. And then secondly, we have implicitly made use of something called a partial trace. Implicitly introduced the partial trace operation. Okay, so what is it? So let OAB be an element of the linear operators on HA tensor HB. Then OA can be defined as the partial trace of B over OAB. So we use a subscript B to denote partial trace, where we're tracing out system B. This is exactly analogous to calculating a marginal probability distribution. All right, so if I have two events, property A is it going to rain tomorrow? And property B is, are there clouds over London, Ontario today? And then these can be correlated variables. So I have a joint probability distribution of whether it rains on Tuesday and there were clouds over London at some point on Monday. And then if I just want to say, so that we can assign probabilities to these events over the course of a year, and then we can say, well, what's the probability just that it's going to rain here on Tuesday? And then what you do is you sum over the index referring to whether or not there were clouds over London on Monday, and you're just left with the raw probability of it actually that it's going to rain on any particular day or any particular Tuesday in Kitchener. So that's how you calculate a marginal probability. And here it's the same thing. We're calculating a marginal operator, which when O is a density operator, we get a marginal probability. And this is defined as summing over any basis for system B . Okay, so notice that the regular trace takes as input some linear operator and spits out a scalar, right, which is the sum of the diagonals. The partial trace takes as input an operator on one Hilbert space and gives you as output an operator on a smaller Hilbert space. Okay, so just like the marginalization of a problem, you start with the probability distribution on a big vector space, you trace out or marginalize sum over one of the two systems, you're left with the probability distribution with a smaller number of elements. Here we have an operator with a smaller number of elements. And so this notation is a bit concise. What it really means is that OA, the LL prime matrix element of OA, is equal to L sum over K, K, OAB, K, L prime. Yeah, let me move the sum out here so it's clearer. Okay, so we're just taking, take all the matrix elements of OAB and group them together. Basically, when you think about that picture up there, you're taking a matrix element from each of the submatrices and adding them all together to create a new matrix element in a smaller dimensional matrix. All right, so that's called the partial trace. In fact, you can show, I'll leave this as an exercise, you can show that the partial trace operation is the unique operation taking row AB to row A such that the expectation of A is equal to the expectation of A tensor identity for any A. So we want this to be true for any observable. We want this condition to hold. And the unique way to do that is the partial trace. So it's not a way, but it's the unique way to obtain the reduced state. And here, row A is called the reduced state. So this is very common in the theory of entanglement. And in fact, when we start looking at the theory of entanglement, we'll see that the partial trace plays a big role in identifying whether states are entangled. Is that a question or a head scratch? Both, I guess, in that case.
So here's a long notation that I'm getting a little confused. But basically, here in the sum, K is a basis for B, right?
Oh, yeah, thank you. I should have made that clear. So K is an orthonormal basis for B, L is an orthonormal basis for A.
Right, so actually what you're doing there, like the order should be L prime K.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Or is it?
Yeah. I think the point is if we just...
Yeah, if you apply it, yeah.
but you're right that my convention has been to keep the order the same.
Yes.
No matter if it's the dual space or not, and I broke that convention here. So it just somehow it's clearer this way for some reason to me. But you're right to catch that. So let me do that properly. Okay, so the key point here is that K is the same index, and L prime are different. So this gives us different rows and columns of the submatrix are populated, but we're only looking at somehow the diagonal elements of the submatrix, which is what I mean is notice how A is along the diagonal there. We're only interested in the submatrices along the diagonal, which basically means we're throwing away any coherence to do with system B. Any other question? I mean, this is probably, so for how many of you is this not new? Wow. Because of the tutorials or because of prior experience. Okay. All right. So sorry, this was maybe a little bit too low level for you guys on the whole. All right. Any questions then before I move on? Yeah. Here? Can I switch them? Yeah, well, okay, it's a matter of what do we interpret this to mean? And I shouldn't have switched them, is I think the best way to. Over here?
Yeah,
so this is kind of a heuristic formula, which actually means this. I mean, this basically, if you use this rule, you won't go wrong. You say, look, I have matrix elements of this big matrix. I want to find elements of the small matrix, and this is the rule by which I do that. And then this is shorthand for this, which is all, and this is also shorthand for that. Okay. Oh, yeah, that was, yeah. Yeah. Like, this should have a B on it. Yeah, so, I mean, I didn't say this. So, basically, here, K. And L is an orthogonal basis for HA. All right. So, okay, I don't want to bore you guys with stuff you already know. So let me do a quiz. How many of you know what test to apply to a density operator to determine if it's pure or mixed? And I didn't ask how to do it. I asked how many of you know. All right, so I'll just quickly summarize. Okay, so we have three equivalent conditions for purity. Okay, so condition one is that there exists some psi such that rho is equal to the projector onto that psi. Condition two is that trace rho squared is equal to 1. And condition three is that rho squared is equal to rho. Okay, so this looks like a weaker condition than this. Somehow this looks like a stronger constraint than just asking that the trace of the matrix is 1. But because rho is non-negative and normalized, it turns out these are equivalent conditions. Okay, and in practice, we use condition two to test. So if I give you some matrix, and I promise that it's a density operator, and I say, is this a pure state? Is this an ideal preparation? Or was there some noisiness? Is it a mixed state? Then you would just calculate the square of the matrix and evaluate the trace and test. And if it's one, then it's pure. If trace rho squared is less than or equal to 1 and greater than or equal to 1 over d, then it's mixed. Oh, sorry, less than 1. Then rho is mixed, or a mixed state, which means it's not ideal, it's not pure. The lower bound is 1 over d, where the dimension of h is d, so it's never 0. And the maximally mixed state which is rho equal to identity over d is the unique state such that trace of rho squared is equal to 1 over d. Yes?
Can you explicitly say that the size of that number corresponds to how mixed something is? How mixed the state is?
Sure.
Because I don't see it written down. I see people kind of talk about that a lot.
Well, you can also use the entropy.
Yeah.
And they're both, I guess, monotones of purity, but they'll give different scales. So when you talk about how much more mixed is this, if you use the entropy, which we'll introduce shortly, then you get a different numerical estimate than if you use purity.
But I definitely use it, but the other day I tried to find a reference for that, and I couldn't.
Well, probably because entropy is more rigorous. Entropy has other operational significance, but it's an equally valid monotone. Yeah.
Can you also, I think you can also calculate the determinant of rho and if that vanishes. Right,
because
then in some particular basis, if it is a pure state, it only has one
sitting
somewhere, and all the other diagonals are zero. So then you'll see that the determinant is zero.
Oh, that's interesting.
Does that work?
I haven't heard that.
If you have two,
yeah. It won't be. Yeah, if you have a zero eigenvalue, that won't work. Right. Yeah, that won't work. Any other questions about this? This is pretty straightforward. What else do I want to say here? Right. Purification. That's a good one. Have you guys seen purification of mixed states? So if I give you a mixed state, okay, well, let me tell you a couple things. First of all, it turns out that any mixed state, any density operator that has that's not pure, can arise in either of these two modes. So we talked about two mechanisms which gave rise to noise or imperfections, non-idealities, mixedness in our description of the preparation. The first mode was via just taking classical mixtures of different preparations. And the second mode was through the state being entangled with some larger Hilbert space. So you might say, oh, well, how can I tell if this density operator I was given is mixed because of mode one, classical mixing, or because of mechanism two, I shouldn't call it mode, mechanism two, which involves entanglement. And it turns out that's not a well-defined question. Well, it's a well-defined question, but it's not an answerable question empirically given the density operator, because any mixed state can be expressed as a mixture of pure states or can be realized via partial trace, which means as the reduced state from an entangled state on a larger Hilbert space. So the sets of objects we get from both mechanisms are the same. But suppose you're convinced that your mixed state came from entanglement with another system. There's the question, how can I purify that mixed state? So how can I express some candidate pure state that would give rise to this rho AB? So how to find purifications? So we're going to use the Schmidt decomposition. Okay, so we have rho for our Hilbert space A. Okay, we find its spectral decomposition by diagonalizing it. So rho is going to be equal to a sum over L, PL, psi L, where psi L are orthonormal. And the PL are obviously eigenvalues. Okay, then we can define a state psi in HA tensor HB via its Schmidt decomposition. right? So that means we're going to write down, we know that there exists some decomposition of this form. Phi L on system A, tensor, let's call it omega L on system B, where phi L and omega L are orthonormal bases. Okay, then we can calculate the reduced state from this. Then rho A obtained from psi is going to be equal to a sum over L square root of lambda L phi L phi L, which you can do as an exercise. And then it turns out we can just then identify these with the PLs. So we set PL equal to square root of lambda L and phi L equal to psi L. So then the quantum state, which has this Schmidt decomposition, yeah, so these states are in row A. So here psi L I think it's okay. What's
down here you have
phi and psi are both in HA. And in fact we're gonna define them to be the same vectors. This is omega. I just needed a new symbol. When I have three states I run out of psi, phi, sometimes I use chi, but here I'm just using omega, just some other state. I mean, we could call it phi b or something.
Maybe the confusion is that you have a subscript of a for that word.
Here? Oh, here, yeah. Oh, sorry, yeah, here. Well, the problem is here. This is the state we want to find its spectral decomposition for. This is the state we want to find a pure state that gives rise to it. I'm saying, let this pure state with lambda L equals square. I got this backwards. Let lambda L equal the square root of PL. Write out a Schmidt decomposition where these vectors are exactly the orthonormal basis. So this is what you start with, and this is what you write down. And then when you take the partial trace of this, you get a density operator rho A from the partial trace, which is then equal to rho. I did this a little clumsily. That's the logic. Should I repeat that one more time, or is it clear? Maybe I'll take a question.
In the last line, the lambda A that circled, shouldn't that be lambda A squared instead of square root?
Is that how I define the Schmidt decomposition? No. No, it's lambda L here, yeah. And the sum of the squares of these add to 1. So if we take lambda L equal to the square root of PL, then the sum of the squares of this add to 1, right? Because the square of the square root is...
But if you want to identify rho A and rho,
No, I'm pretty sure this is right. All right, so, so what I had first was right. All right, sorry.
Don't we get?
Yeah.
No.
What?
Don't we get rho A by forming the...
Look, here's how we check it. Sum over L, lambda L squared is equal to 1, and we want sum over L, PL to be equal to 1. So we want PL to equal lambda L squared. We want lambda L to equal to square root of PL. Okay, second time I had it right then. So this is correct because of these conditions. Oh, so down here. Oh, it's down here that's the problem. Okay, sorry. So what do I want? This not square rooted? Squared. All right. Thank you very much. Sorry about that.
This top row, should this be a sum over phi L instead of psi L?
Well, I identified phi L with psi L somewhere.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, I don't think I explained this as well as I could have. Sorry about that. Yeah, I should have just called this psi L. Whatever. They're the same. What I meant to write is a general expression for this and a general expression for this and show that the reduced state of this corresponds to that if we make these two identifications. That's the point I wanted to make.
Is there any constraint on the dimension of E?
That's a good question. Yeah, so depending on how mixed your state is, you need more and more dimension Hilbert space to accommodate that. The more mixed, if the mixedness of rho, or rho A as it's called here, arises from entanglement, then the more mixed it is, the more entanglement you need, which means the dimensionality has to increase. But the maximum you ever need is the matching dimension. So if Hilbert space HA has dimension N, then having a Hilbert space HB of dimension N is sufficient to give rise to a maximally mixed state via a maximally entangled state. And so that's sufficient for any degree of entanglement or any degree of mixedness. That's a good point.
It just needs to be rank of the reduced density of
the. Yeah. Yeah, in fact, that's in the notes, so you'll see it there. And it's important to realize that this is non-unique. Okay, so this is called the purification. So under this identity, this is called the purification of rho. So we take rho on HA and express it as a pure state on a bigger Hilbert space, so it's called a purification. And the purification of rho, sorry, my handwriting is getting really sloppy. The purification of rho is not unique. Okay, so we can see that because we can always apply identity on A tensor some unitary V on system B to our purification. And this will give rise to the same rho A. I don't know why this level is too low. Okay, so we can change this state psi via a local unitary transformation on system B. And obviously, by special relativity, something that's happening locally to system B can't impact the thing that generates our statistics for system A. Notice I called it the thing that generates our statistics, not the state. Just bear that in mind. Can't repeat that enough for people. OK, so I think that's a good point to stop. Tomorrow, we'll start discussing how to describe generalized measurement, which is operationally quite useful in lots of settings. Thanks for all the great questions today.